It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to another episode of the John Mack Radio Show. It's our 76th continuous broadcast. My most recent column for Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. It's the 150th column in the Creative Disruption series. But I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if the need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmac13@gmail.com. You'll also find links to previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper, which is free, by the way, at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. Try it and subscribe. There's only one email per day. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-916-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the end of the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is technologist, system designer, political activist, Linda Lawson Kemp. I first met Linda, if met is the correct word, when the number of years ago I noted her many Facebook postings and began to first share them with my friends and followers, and then to curate them more recently for my daily newspaper. But I also noted that we shared a background in system design and implementation, and that became the subject of discussion and cross-pollination of sources and technologies. Finally, we both were involved somewhat in the Occupy movement. Me as the visitor to the Occupy Wall Street in New York City, and Linda as an active participant in D.C. area Occupy groups. We'll explore all of Linda's interesting life tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Linda.
Hi. Good talking with you again.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Oh, I grew up in a little town called Hazel Crest, which is about 23-ish miles south of the Chicago Loop.
And you went to grammar school there? Then where did you go to high school?
Grammar school in Hazel Crest. There were a couple. I started out in a little school called Warren Palm, which was named after I think it was a World War I military hero of some type. I should know that, but I don't. And then they built a new school called Woodland, and I spent my last 4 years of grade school at Woodland. And then high school was in Harvey, Illinois, Thornton Township High School. So it was neighborhood grade schools, rather small grade schools. And in fact, I'm still in touch with several of my grade school buddies, actually, because a lot of us we knew each other, and we went through all eighth grade, actually, together as a group. And so we still keep in touch. And then high school in the town north of us was a huge high school. And so I don't really keep in touch anywhere near so much with anybody from high school. But that was a good school. All of them were good schools. I was blessed with good schools.
You told me on the phone recently that although you live and work in the D.C. area, you've also focused on possible ways of revitalizing the Harvey. Before we go on with your life, please explain what Harvey was like in your childhood, what happened to it over the years, and what you think could be done to turn it around.
Oh, Harvey is. I just became aware. Harvey has been in decline for several decades, actually. It was conceived and built as a speculative deal, actually, as small manufacturing cities just off of Chicago. And so they were, actively, the developers were actively soliciting, manufacturers to come into town. And they, built up a lot of houses, of course. And it's literally a small city. And it was thriving there for quite a while. It was a destination. Here's my thing. Several years ago, I was doing genealogy, research and extended family, and that a lot of them came to Harvey. My ancestral roots are Scotland and Sweden, and so. And they came around the 1903 to 1905 area, vicinity, time frame. And so on some of the records coming into the country, it's a destination. And one of the things that caught my attention was it did not say Chicago, and it didn't say Harvey, Illinois. It just said Harvey, which means that, in New York and in Europe, they knew Harvey was a destination. It was well known then, and so that was up to about a century ago when people were still coming in. They were flocking to Harvey for the new manufacturing jobs. Both parts of my family, included. And then after World War II, it kind of started to decline, and for various and sundry reasons, and it's been kind of a slow decline, and a lot of manufacturing in the recent decades of West. And here the last couple of years, it's really taken a nosedive. So here's this idyllic, from a century ago, small city, great school, great high school, et cetera, et cetera. I worked there. My first job was there, right on the main drag in Harvey. And now it's the crime capital in the entire Chicago land area. And that needs to be turned around. And so I had some ideas. I don't know to what extent they might be feasible, but I'm just kind of trying to get some ideas, together, and some of my contacts that, maybe we can cook up some new business coming into Harvey, feed some new startups that would end up, for example, being worker-owned co-ops of various, various innovative, 21st century businesses. The location is superb, just immediately south of Chicago. So railroad connections, interstate highways, commuter train, a major commuter train, goes right through Harvey and up into, the loop. And lots of vacant land right now in prime locations, that, where old factory buildings were, there are no more. And so it just has so many things going for it. And the people that are there now, deserve a life and deserve it to be rejuvenated. So if there's anything that I can do to help move that along, I would love to be a positive force in that. So that's kind of where that's at.
If it's that close to Chicago, and if it's got good highway and a good train connections, why hasn't it turned into a bedroom community?
Downward spiral. It's a vicious downward spiral. Jobs, the manufacturers moved out. They left a lot of manufacturing buildings, factories that were contaminated, soil around there. They left, they just abandoned them. So you have crumbling factory buildings with toxic soil, sitting in very large lots of toxic soil. And everything, there was no jobs and everything just started declining. And then in a lot of areas, the very typical thing that happens is, you start getting you know, people are without work, so, you know, drugs moved in, and, you know, crime and gangs and corruption and all kinds of negative things. And so how to break that cycle? Because, you know, jobs aren't going to move in, you know, when employers are, you know, potential investors are put off by, you know, the crime, et cetera, and just the look of the place because it looks dilapidated. And so the longer that goes on, you know, the crime just gets worse. So it's a vicious cycle that needs to, there needs to be a monkey wrench thrown into that vicious cycle to stop it and turn it around and start creating a virtual, virtual cycle. That's a positive fight cycle as opposed to a negative one.
What kind of, when you say 21st century industry, are you thinking of internet businesses or remote things, or do you have some new industry in mind?
I see it as a potential perfect place to start, for example, with community gardens and food forests that would eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later, would turn into like urban farms, including vertical farms, you know, meaning indoor buildings that are like hydroponic, that, you know, with artificial light in that grow organic food, that could be, you know, stood up as startups, being, you know, hopefully worker-owned, you know, or at least community-owned, that would, number one, help feed the community good quality organic food, and that then could generate some revenue that would be, that the benefits of which would go to the residents of the community and provide some jobs and, you know, get some good-paying jobs. And the money would stay in the community as opposed to being siphoned off to some other owners, you know, living, you know, somewhere else, right? So it would stay and circulate in the community. So I see that. I see the non-carbon-based energy. I could see that as like a solar tech manufacturing center, wind technology manufacturing center. I mean, it's situated such that, you know, they could do that. And manufacturing is in their DNA there, right? So I see that happening. I see all kinds of things. It's a good high school there. I would love to see some data scientists churned out of the high school and the community college that's there. You know that there, you know, there's a bunch of kids there that would, you know, would make good data scientists. I see building trades being taught with some collaboration with the town. I mean, there's so many vacant houses, for example, that are there in town that many of which could be refurbed. So what if there was a building trades program at the high school and or community college that a project, you know, could be refurbing some of these houses and maybe provide housing for the students who could then, you know, do refab of houses as a job. Perhaps toxic cleanup of soil. I mean, there's a lot of toxic soil there that needs to be cleaned up. What a better place to start developing some expertise that other places might need, right? I mean, they've got plenty of soil that they can practice on cleaning up in their own, you know, vicinity and provide some expertise. I see that. I mean, there's just so many things, I think, that could happen there. Anything is open.
I know that Iowa is known throughout the country for its wind generation of electricity. Is the same type of fields in Harvey as there are in northern Iowa where it's open to wind generation?
Further south, it is. Harvey itself, I mean, there would be some, yes, but it's more urban than that. It's not open. It's not a lot of open fields. So some of it could happen, yes, absolutely. there's some things, you know, the there's some, you know, rivers and, you know, some creeks and one of the Little Calumet River or something like that runs through Harvey. And there's some technology, for example, that can go into a river that takes advantage of the flow of the, you know, the flow of the, it doesn't disrupt anything. It sits on the bottom of the riverbed and or creek bed, and you know, as the water flows, it, you know, turns, you know, whatever turbine, and generates electricity. So I could see some of that. I see more solar. I mean, I see it. Who knows? I mean, this may or may not be feasible. It's nothing more than an idea. But I see, given their location there, I could, and their manufacturing history, I see it as being able to manufacture and install and maintain solar for the entire Chicagoland area. And given the fact that they're right there on railroads and interstates, you know, ostensibly anywhere. They could support almost anywhere.
Are you looking for funding for this, or for state funds, or are you going to pursue it to a business plan, or what are your plans in this area?
Yeah, I want to start. I haven't really started. Yeah, I have so many ideas. I just haven't boiled it down because it's such a big challenge. I want to start a business plan, actually, and I have to step up and say I haven't really, and most of that is my own lack of diligence as far as just sitting down and putting my nose to the grindstone and just, you know, putting it out. And part of the reason for that is that there's so many opportunities and so many moving parts. You know, how do you, it's a big process to try to, you know, lay it down on paper in some organized, you know, fashion. As far as what, you know, what could be, so that's, you know, I need to do that pretty quickly. And then I started communicating with several people back there. You know, I'm 700 miles away, and I have all these ideas, but I'm very cognizant of the fact that my ideas, many of which are going to be ivory tower, and some of these are going to be feasible. I just don't know which ones or how many. But people there on the ground will be able to discern which are feasible, which are the best, the most feasible to do first, if any. You know, so I need people there who know what's going on there, as opposed to me off 700 miles away who hasn't lived there since 1967. You know, so I have a lot of ideas. I figure if I come up with 200 ideas, if, you know, a dozen of them end up being feasible and doable and can get funding and can blossom, well, that's a dozen that, you know, didn't happen otherwise.
Sure.
You know, the ones that don't, you know.
Now, you mentioned as the city went into decline, the drugs and crime arrived. Has that been cleaned out, or would you have to get rid of that too?
That's part of the problem. No, it needs to happen simultaneously. Yeah, it's a chicken and egg thing. I'm convinced. I'm a system. You know that, John. I'm an old systems analyst. I know in my bones that things can be arranged such that it can undermine the problem. That it can disrupt those problems. Keeping the community intact, as opposed to, you know, taking that, you know, catastrophic kind of an approach to doing renovation that wants to clear out all, you know, clear out and start over. You know, no, we, you know, there's community there. And so it's a matter of providing options that are doable, that are stood up in such a way, this is what I have in my mind, stood up in such a way that they are protected from the negative stuff and, you know, can take hold and eventually become a positive force that, you know, that becomes the mainstream and eventually overtakes the negative. That's what I have in mind. I view it as a systems problem.
Okay.
And being an old systems analyst, I know that there's all kinds of ways to skin a cat. So.
After high school, you left the Harvey area for Colorado and college. Was there the degree of culture shock when you got to Colorado?
Yeah, culture and ecology. I've never been a Colorado fan, actually. I went out there. My husband, we got married in 67, and he just had come back from Vietnam and was stationed in Colorado Springs. And so we went out there and ostensibly for 6 months. And then he fell in love with Colorado. And so we ended up staying and then eventually moving to Denver. Colorado never really fit me, and he died a number of years ago, and I ended up leaving, and actually was kind of on my way to go to Boston. I always wanted to live in Boston. I was, in my mind, I wanted to go and do a doctorate in Boston, and but I had a job offer to move to Arlington, Virginia, and I ended up out here, and never made it to Boston. I'm still here.
I know that at some point in your Colorado time that you went to the University of Denver, where you were the magna cum laude, and you went from a business degree undergraduate to advanced study in information technology, including artificial intelligence and knowledge management. What stayed
right.
you in that direction?
Following my nose. Just following my nose. I've never had a life plan. I've always, you know, when I started out, my parents weren't rich. And so I started out working in high school, actually, in my senior year. And I wanted to go to Northern Illinois University and do a degree in architecture, specializing in restoration of historical places. Because I was really intrigued by history, both history and architecture, and never made it for various reasons. In order to be able to put money together in order to go to school, I started, what was hot back then was key punching. So I started key punching. Went to technical school in Hammond, Indiana, and learned how to key punch, got a job key punching, and then that was just to earn money because that was what was hot back then. It was easy to get into, and, you know, there was demand, and so that's what I went into. And so then in one of my jobs, key punching, it was a small place up in south of Chicago, another suburb in Chicago, and there was a programmer there, and I kept nosing around, like, what you doing? And he started teaching me RPG programming. And I decided that was kind of fun. And then got married, and we moved out to Colorado, and I got a job doing RPG programming. And kind of one thing led to another. And so I ended up getting a business degree at University of Denver, which was, even though I was doing IT at the time, business degree is always, you know, just a good degree to have. And actually the combination of business administration and computer information systems is a good one. And the whole idea of artificial intelligence, just that was intriguing. They had a certificate program. It's like, well, why not? Right, and that was a really good move. AI is a different approach, and it's a different mindset. So that was really useful because it brings a different perspective on business problems, on technology, technological problems, and on business problems. Kind of like learning algebra changed the way that I looked at doing grammar, English grammar, if you can believe that. It's like a pattern that you learn. It's like, oh, that's useful. And the artificial intelligence certificate, I mean, it's not a, you know, master's degree or anything like that. It was just a certificate, but it was several classes, and they were really, really useful to me. And it changed my way of thinking, and it was really, really useful. So one of the things I got into, I was doing expert systems development there for a couple of years at Martin Marietta at the time. And so actually, I think that's how I got into it. Yeah, actually, that is. I got the job doing developing expert systems, so I was kind of learning on the job, and then it's like, okay, I think I'll go get a certificate in this. So I got the certificate for AI, and that was really useful. So.
I do mention RPG. I remember that was the primary programming language for the System 34 and System 36. What were you using it on?
What was it? I'm trying to remember. It was, what was the first one? I can't remember what the first one was. And then they got a 360, IBM 360. And then a UNIVAC, what was it, UNIVAC 9000.
Okay.
I started I was at the International Typographical Union for several years. And that was doing RPG and COBOL programming on UNIVAC 9000.
I remember there was an RPG for the 7070, but it wasn't very powerful. So what we did was we, in addition to writing and then autocoder and then, mm-hmm. then patching the machine language, we used to modify the sorts and the merges so we wouldn't have to do any IOCS. We just could go right in. You know, they already handled the files for us, and we could write our programs. They have branching out of the routines and the utilities.
Yeah.
Your ABD, Orbit Dissertation at George Washington,
right.
Will you finish?
I finished all the coursework, and I did most of my preparation for doing my dissertation.
Hello?
Much research. Are you there? Hello? Hello?
Belinda?
Can you hear me? Yeah?
Something seems to have happened. Either I'm not hearing her or she's not there. Are you there, Linda?
I don't know. No, I'm here. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I got you.
That's weird.
As I mentioned, your ABD at George Washington, will you finish on that or no?
I finished all the coursework, and I started my dissertation. I did tons and tons and tons of research. And I don't really want to go into it, but there was a mismatch of what I was doing in my research and what the expectations were.
Okay.
And I was not going to go back and start over and do something that was not important to me. And it was just a mismatch, and I ran out of time. So I've actually used that research since then, multiple times since then. So it's, you know, that was worthwhile doing. Basically what I was doing was linking the knowledge management paradigm, which is a huge umbrella, and, you know, taking a systems approach, but applying it to enterprise risk management, which at the time was just emerging. It was not well defined at all. Weren't not too many people really talking about it. And the ones that were was really stovepipes. You know, so enterprise risk management was viewed, you know, if you were an insurance company, they had their own definition. If you were, you know, some other kind of company, they had their own, you know, it was really parochial. And I was taking a very broad, strategic, almost existential approach to enterprise risk management, which was not how enterprise risk management at the time tended to be conceived or defined. So I was kind of breaking ground there, and I became aware that if you're going to manage enterprise risk, what you really need to do is manage knowledge about enterprise risk. Right, and then I found confirmation of that. There was a woman, I can't remember her name now, and she was kind of leading the field. She was in enterprise. She was in environmental risk in Leeds University in England. And she wrote an article, and she sent me seen several things that she had written. And I contacted her, and she sent me an early version of an article that she was about to write, which basically said, you know, enterprise risk is enterprise knowledge, or management of enterprise risk knowledge, right? So she was equating the two. She was saying, you know, this, you know, enterprise risk management is enterprise risk knowledge management. And she had a whole article on that, and she sent me an early version of it. And it's now been published by somebody else under that was subsequently changed quite a bit and with a different title and everything. The reason being, she was one, this is tragic, she and her daughter went out to, where was that, was it 2004 tsunami? When that tsunami hit in Indonesia?
Okay.
She and her daughter were taken out in the tsunami.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Would you define enterprise risk for our audience?
Oh, I haven't in so long. I don't know if I can say it trippingly off the tongue. It, you know, I see it as existential risk to the organization. So things that should be keeping the executives up at night, either are keeping them up at night or should be keeping them up at night, that can do the organization in. So it could be a threat of, you know, a financial threat. It could be a political threat. If you're a foreign company, for example, and you've got, you know, some real political problems going on. Could be that. It could be a tsunami hit. Could be terrorism. It could be any numbers of things, right? Could be some of the managers have made some wrong decisions, and you get hit with some lawsuits, you know, that take you out enough to, you know, that are significant enough to take you out. Any kind of form that could basically undermine your entire business, which could be anything.
It would seem to me that one of the biggest threats now is technology threats, that the technology gets away from us. Even if we look at Kodak, I mean, they were the ones that invented the digital camera, and they chose to hold on to it because it would impact the film processing business, and by the time they got around to it, the game was over. Now, how would you analyze something like that? How would you have enough information to know that now is the time to spring the genie out of the bottle?
They really are the poster child that's brought up as the quintessential example all the time. Well, I think for one thing, it would be to recognize it and to be aware. To be much more aware and much more active when things start changing in the exterior environment. So when you put a systems model over that, awareness is a really big thing. Awareness and comprehension of the information that you're gathering from outside, right? Rather than, you know, staying willfully ignorant of what's happening on the outside, which in a situation like that, it's usually willful ignorance that gets, you know, in the way. Most catastrophic kind of problems, there's usually foreknowledge that things are going awry that's usually ignored. You know, when you look at all these, you know, really big problems, virtually always, there are people in the organizations who are, you know, raising the red flag, but they're being ignored because that's politically incorrect, or that's not what we had in our plans, or we don't want to hear about it, right? And I think Kodak is an example of that. So how do you raise that? Well, number one, you make it explicit as opposed to hide it, you know, and when you make it more explicit, now you have to deal with it. And you can rank it, and, you know, when you start making it explicit, when you start recognizing it and making it explicit, now you have something that you can actually manage rather than just ignore. And most of that, you know, it doesn't happen. All these kinds of stories, for the most part, it just doesn't happen.
Now so, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and knowledge management brings some, a paradigm that, ostensibly anyway, helps making these kinds of things explicit where they can be tracked, sometimes measured, but at least tracked and kept in the forefront of your mind as opposed to ignored, easily pushed, set aside and ignored because they were uncomfortable to deal with. Actually, one of the things that happened along the way is I found a technology. There's a lot of tools out there that are considered under the umbrella of knowledge management or KM, and the portals, et cetera. And so I was involved in that for a while. But it was a technology that in my research I happened across and actually made a phone call and connected with this person that kind of blew me away because it was like the quintessential knowledge management system tool. And it stuck in, it stuck with me because it had a system, it was consistent with systems, it was consistent with recognizing a situation and keeping it at the forefront, provided a means of keeping things at a forefront rather than dismissing them along the way, making them, real issues invisible, right? But kept things at the forefront and actually gave a way of ranking and rating issues and figuring out what the real risks are based on various and sundry forces and criteria, and then making a decision on, what are the most important risks versus the least important risks. And what happens is the most important risks have a tendency to be forgotten, and a lot of energy, including the energy that goes into making decisions, has a tendency to be focused on lesser risks, right? But there was a company that I found, Quantelia was its name, or is its name, and they had a product called World Modeler, which is knock your socks off, and it's the best knowledge management technology that I ever found, and so that kind of intrigued me. But it's a really good tool, actually.
Back in 2000, you delivered the paper to a government technology conference. The measurement is fundamental to managing an enterprise, the knowledgeability. And over the years, like Bill Gates wrote a famous article just about 3 years ago on how important measurement and matrix are.
Yeah.
But many companies see this constant gathering of data, if it can't be done electronically, as interfering with its normal work. How do you get around that? You get people to, number one, to identify what should be measured, and number two, to bring the tools in to measure it.
Yeah, that's a tricky. Measurement is a double-edged sword because that old saying, what you measure gets done. It really does apply. And if you pick the wrong measures, you can be actually setting up and enforcing the exact opposite of what you really need to do. Yeah, for a lot of years I was involved in the whole measurement thing, including when I was at Software Productivity Consortium years ago, and I did a whole bit of research and wrote a major working paper, actually, technology paper, technical report there on enterprise, what was the name of it now? Enterprise measurement. Enterprise performance measurement. That's what it was. Enterprise performance measurement. So when you boil it up to the enterprise level, as opposed to just, you know, whatever, a task or, you know, product or whatever, you boil it up at the enterprise level, it gets really involved, and it spans strategic. This is where my business degree came in. I mean, it really spans strategic planning, strategic thinking, systems thinking, right? Because you have to take into consideration secondary and tertiary effects, you know, and unanticipated effects, right? And you have to, tweaking it. You know, there needs to be a feedback loop because you might put all of the, you know, really smart, rational thinking in place to figure out what should be the best measures, but you need to keep monitoring it and, you know, to figure out whether or not that was, you know, might have sounded like a good idea, but was it really? Because as soon as you have to keep monitoring, because as soon as you start seeing, well, we're having a negative effect from this measurement as opposed to a positive effect. It seems like, for example, if you start measuring quantities as opposed to quality, a lot of times, you know, that can send the wrong thing. For example, if you start measuring how many, you know, customer support, how many calls people take as opposed to, you know, customer satisfaction, you know, rating, for example, right? Well, now people are motivated to take as many calls as they can, you know, superseding how satisfied their customers are who are calling in for assistance, right, which is certainly has the opposite effect of what you intended to do.
Well,
so you have
from
to be really careful.
From the statistics course that I teach and everything, it's a lot easier to measure quantity than quality. It's a quality.
Yep.
is so much more subjective than pure numbers. So it's very easy to fall into that trap, I'm sure.
It really is easy, it's easy just because it's easy. Actually, the more important things are the harder things. They're usually the more important and the fuzzier things. If it's easy and if it's really clear, you have to really question: is it really important? Because too often the stuff that's the easiest or is the most obtainable is really low-level stuff. And a lot of times, you know, measurement, the most important measures are the fuzzy measures, you know, the qualitative as opposed to quantitative. But, of course, it's the qualitative that, you know, that's available. And so that tends to be, you know, there's a lot of tendency to go in and measure what's there as opposed to what's needed. Years ago, I started equating it to, as an analogy, you know, medicines in your medicine cabinet. And so you've got, you know, you have an illness and, you know, you look in the medicine cabinet and say, well, I already have this, so I'm going to take this. Whether or not it has anything to do with your illness or not, you know, it's available and it's easy and it's cheap, so all you just take this. And
right.
That's, you know, what I've seen too many times happen with measurement as opposed to, and it can cause more harm, just like bad medicine, you know, can cause more harm than it can solve. It can make a bad problem worse.
You mentioned that you wanted to go to Boston, but you got waylaid to the D.C. area by the job offer. What was the job that brought you to D.C.?
I was visiting Chicago, actually, at a grade school reunion, and I had finished up my master's, and I had been laid off from Martin Marietta. You know, it's like any other, you know, company like that. I mean, they were always doing, you know, hires and layoffs, and I was laid off, and it's like, okay, well, a year to year and a half from now, I'll be picked up, so I'm just going to take the time and finish my master's, and so I did that, and after I did that, immediately after I did that in the spring, there was a grade school reunion back in Chicago, and so I just drove to Chicago. And so I'm visiting family, and, well, I'm looking for a job anyway. I just check out the Chicago Tribune, and so I checked out there and found a job and interview for it, got hired, and it was for, there was a project, it was for, this was FDIC at the time, and it was for the EPA, and they had a Chicago office for the Great Lakes, supporting some stuff going on for the Great Lakes to the EPA. And I took it and I started there, and it was actually a project that was run out of Arlington here. So Chicago was like a satellite office. And I started, and like 3 or 4 days after I started, there was a problem on the contract, and we got a cease and desist order. So we had to finish up the task order that we were on, so that was about 4 or 5 weeks. And I had to decide, do I want to look for another job in Chicago? I looked for one, wasn't able to find one. And they made me an offer. They said, if you want to move out to, you have a job with us, if you want to just move back to the office in Arlington, and just continue, the work will be different, but it's the same project, same program. And I wasn't going to do it. I was thinking about going to Boston and seeing what was up there. And I went out drinking with my brother. You're here with 2 suitcases in the car, and you got a job. You've never been to D.C. Go to D.C., see if you like it. If you like it, stay. And if you don't, go to Boston or come back here or go back to Denver. I decided that was a pretty good idea.
So you're in the right place at the right time. Your recent experience has been involvement in the federal judiciary system. How did you get involved there, and what is unique about federal courts?
Oh, there's a lot of things unique. I really like federal courts, actually. And I think real highly of them, actually. That was one of the better customers that I've ever had. And that was, I was without a task. The company I was with was without a task at the time. And so they sent me out on an interview out to the administrative office of the U.S. Court in D.C. And I got hired, I got approved by the client, and so they added me to that task. And actually, what the task was, it was unique. It was a really unique task. I was like a one-man show. It was a one-person task order, and it was doing a special project for this one group at the AO, and it sounded really innocent. It was an innocent little do an online survey, ask budgetary information, because every few years they revisit their allotment formulas. Because the money comes in from Congress to the federal judiciary, and then the federal judiciary divvies it up. A federal court that's in Manhattan, Kansas, of course, would have entirely different needs, IT needs, than a court in Manhattan, New York, as you might imagine, right? And so figuring out, there's a whole assortment of allotment formulas for IT, for court technology, specific court technology, and as well as the IT system, for staff, for probation, yada, yada, right? So there's formalized allotment formulas, based on a whole assorted criteria. And they revisit those formulas every few years, to keep them fair and get the money allotted in the most, one of the larger allotment formulas was for IT equipment, so servers and, all of that kind of stuff. And so this was to create a survey, online survey, in order to collect information to help them when they tweaked to their formula, updated their formula. It was a real Pandora's box. So there was a working group that was set up with a bunch of court executives from around the country that we had weekly virtual meetings, and then they would come in every 6 weeks or something like that. They would come into D.C. and we would have this big meeting, and they were they were the ones that were, I mean, we were going back and forth on how to set the survey up and what to ask and what not to ask and how to ask it and all that kind of stuff. So I was working with them, and it kept growing and growing and growing. And what they ended up wanting actually went beyond. There was a piece of software, online survey software that they had, and finally settled on that they actually wanted out of the survey was beyond the capability of that survey software. And they actually then funded the survey software to create some improvements to the software itself. They still couldn't do it. They could not reach, you know, they could not handle it. And majority, the reason for that was the survey software was based, it was the database system, for example, and at its heart. I had an AI degree. Or an AI certificate, right? I knew the difference between conventional system approaches and an AI approach, and it was absolutely clear to me that what was missing, you know, why they couldn't handle this was some very, from in the AI world, very flexibility that just was not available, was not ever going to be available in this software. And so they said, you know, go forth and find a technology that could do this. And I did a huge search, you know, well over a dozen companies of expert systems, BI tools. One of the largest, I think it was the largest online survey tool, and some other ones, some other technologies of put out by companies that, John, I know that you would recognize as being household words, okay? And everybody was trying to throw their technology at this, these unique user requirements. None of them could do it. Everything was a square peg in a round hole because none of them had a very big AI approach in order to be able to divvy up the survey on the fly and, you know, recreate parts of it, you know, slice and dice it to people that we didn't know ahead of time who were going to be recipients, you know, and be able to, and then reel all the pieces, you know, it, through multiple layers, any number of layers, and then reel it back in, right? So quite frankly, what happened was in desperation, when one household name company came and had a meeting with my customer, they flew up some key engineers, two key engineers from out of state, one of the southern states, southwestern state, and we went through the first level of user requirements, and you know, it's like, oh, not a problem, you know, oh, that's easy, right? And next level, they were like, right, and their eyes got big, right? And then the next level down, you know, oh, by the way, it needs to do this, and they were like deer in the headlights. Oh, we'll figure it out. We got really good engineers. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. And, you know, they were trying to throw workflow at it and, you know, all different kinds of things and automated forms and stuff like that. And it was all square peg in a round hole. They didn't have the underlying technology. They were using all these, you know, scotch tape and staples, right, as opposed to being able to have something that was designed in order to solve the problem to begin with. And so I went out of that meeting and was like, geez, you know, I want this to work for my customer. And I remember this company, this knowledge manager, which I, you know, they were not a knowledge management system, you know, tool vendor, but I recognize it as being like the quintessential top knowledge management system platform. And so I called this gal and I explained what the user requirements were and the frustration that, you know, nobody could solve this. And I said, this is outside of what you do, but I suspect that your underlying platform could do this. And she said, oh, yeah, no problem. Let me tell you how we could do it. Okay. It makes sense to me. Total sense to me. They nailed it. It was so easy because they had the underlying technology to be able to do this. And so we collaborated, and they were the only ones that could, you know, we sent out to all these people, you know, the user requirements and all of these other companies responded, and none of them could answer all of the have to requirements. You know, all of them were able to answer, you know, were able to supply most of them, but not all of them, you know. And then the nice to have, none of them could answer any of the nice to haves that we had listed, right? And so this company, they came back. And they answered not only all of the have-to-haves, they answered all of the nice-to-haves. And they threw in, I forget, three or four or five extra ones. You know, well, this is what you're doing, and we think that this would be a really benefit, too. You know, if you gave this to us, we would be glad to fill this in, no problem, because we can do it easy, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, so my customer was blown away, and they got this. You know, they got a sole source on that because they were the only ones that could match requirements. And so then they proceeded to knock it out of the park. And then we got a follow-on, and then they got another follow-on. And I would love to see some more work there, actually. I see all kinds of places where this could be used, actually. So, and that was a long-winded answer.
You mentioned talking about the integration of knowledge management out of artificial intelligence tools. Have you been paying attention to the Watson development, where they're calling everything machine learning now? Have you looked at that at all?
Shame on me, I haven't. Actually, this person with Quantelia is she's a world expert in machine learning. I have not been tracking. I mean, I know about it, but I'm not. I mean, I know how to spell it, and I know conceptually what it is, but as far as the nuts and bolts, I know very, very little. But
the demo of the way that it broke down the Jeopardy questions is just terrific. Now they're in bed with a whole bunch of companies. They're in bed with Sloan Kettering and doing cancer work, and with other companies, and with the Japanese company now. It just looks very interesting. It looks like a whole new paradigm. Speaking of the federal courts, you've recently gotten involved with the startup to aid the judiciary system in obtaining services to retire, the past workers in the system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a cool deal, actually. Basically, I spent enough time down in courts that I knew what a lot of their systems problems were, and I talked during the whole survey process. I had talked with enough people there that I had a good sense of what was going on and where their frustrations were and where their problems were. And I also became aware of there being a lot of retired. Yeah, the federal judiciary people, the executives there tend to start with the judiciary, and they spend most of their careers there, and so they have a long tenure there, 20, 30 years or more, and they all know each other, and they all respect each other. They know who the good ones are, and they have usually worked on, together on various working groups, et cetera, and so they know each other, and it's not that big of a community to begin with, and there was a need for some of these retired people. Because they have such deep expertise. But there wasn't really a way to get to them easily because to contract with them individually, it's different. The administrative office, for example, it wasn't really convenient for them to hire an individual, for a couple of days a week or 2 months or a week or whatever to interject some expertise here or there on some special project, or some court out somewhere, right? And my employer could have, they have the contract, the IDIQ contract to supply, this expertise, but they didn't want to be hiring, this person for a couple of weeks or that person for a couple of days or this other person for a couple of months or 2 days a week or whatever. Because the administrative cost is just too high. And so I was trying to convince them to you know, to do this. And basically I found a guy who is a retired federal court executive who was into the idea of starting his own business and hiring these people himself and then being a subcontractor to my company. So my company, it was a win-win-win-win all the way around, right? So these people could, you know, pick and choose, you know, whether if there was a job that was posted that, you know, if they needed this or that expertise, if the individuals could, you know, well, I'm going to bid on that one or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they all knew this guy who started this company, right? And so this guy would, you know, if there was a need for, you know, this kind of expertise, you know, that need would, you know, that that would roll down, to, that, you know, task order would roll down to him through my company, and he would hire these guys, right? Who were known people. And my company would only have to deal with one guy, and then, of course, it would be under our umbrella contract anyway, so it was easy for the client, for the courts, because they, you know, they would just contract for an additional task order for the, you know, through us, and then we would sub it to this other guy, and he would get one of these guys who would work for him, and so it was able to be done, you know, because these guys, you know, if the administrative office, for example, you know, wanted somebody just for a few months, or even if they wanted somebody full-time for a long-term project, if somebody is in California might not want to fly out and live for the next year in D.C. They'd be willing to come out for a couple of months or a couple of weeks or, you know, one day a month or whatever, you know, or consult virtually. But they don't want to stick up and move to D.C. and, you know, they're retired. They don't want to do that. So they were, it wasn't a vehicle for them to get that. So this provides a vehicle.
Okay.
So hopefully, yeah, so it's all set up to go now. So we're waiting for everything. The stars are all aligned. We're waiting for task orders to roll down. We're ready for them. If, you know, whenever they decide that, you know, they need this expertise, we've got it, the cream of the crop, both domestically and also internationally, because a lot of these retired guys are also doing consulting internationally through, like, USAID, et cetera. But the Federal Judicial Center, which is a peer organization to the administrative office and located in the same building, also fell under the same contract, umbrella contract that we had. So it's the Federal Judiciary Center, who also did a lot of work collaborating with courts around the world. If there was a need for them to have an expertise to go to some foreign country to help, you know, the judiciary there with their case management or rule of law, you know, guidance or, you know, whatever, just probation or, you know, whatever it is that they could use some help on, you know, or guidance or a different viewpoint, you know, whatever, these guys could be made available. So we're waiting. We're waiting. But, hopefully it'll take off.
Well, good luck with it. I mentioned in the introduction our mutual involvement in the Occupy movement.
Oh, yeah.
In retrospect, do you see a benefit to such movements as Occupy, or do they, as some say, turn off too many people?
I think they did turn off a lot of people, but as far as I'm concerned, it was a huge benefit because it highlighted, you know, some core problems. I spent some time down there. I wasn't really part of it, but I would go, you know, roam around a couple of times on weekends, you know, a couple of evenings I'd go roam around, and a couple of weekends I would go roam around, and there was just a lot of activity there. It was a real positive environment, actually, and I'm asking questions, and actually I got involved on the I said, are you guys doing, you know, any kind of strategic plans? And you know, mission statement or, you know, whatever. And, well, they did. They had a committee for that. And I said, and they said, great, we'd love you to come, right? And so I started going, so I ended up on the declaration committee there. And that was a real experience. You know what happened with that? I got so hopeful. There were, you know, with any group, there's some, you know, clunkers, right? And, you know, there was some people there that were, there were hard and difficult to get along with, et cetera. However, there were the exceptions. There were young people there who were so bright, John. It gave me hope. These kids were thinking. They were genuine. They had great ideas, huge energy, good judgment, just all the right stuff. It's like, man, if this is the caliber of kids that are coming up, it's like, it gives me hope. Really high caliber people there. There was only two old, there was another guy that was my age that was showing up. And the two of us were so glad that we were there because we were the old ones. And the two of us had a different perspective than these kids. And I think, the diversity is always good. And, you know, we had a different perspective that ended up getting put into the mix. You know, and we had a lot of lessons learned and a lot of different perspectives. And
if I remember correctly, though, didn't you have a frustrating time trying to get people to focus and to get out a mission statement? And did you ever wind up doing it or no?
We ended up doing it. It took way too long, and it was a day late and a dollar short. It ended up getting finished. Part of what, you know, you see me ranting a lot on my Facebook page about absolutism. And, you know, people get single focused, and it's like, no, this is the only way that it's right, right? And it has to be this. It has to be this. Nothing else is as good. Everything has to be like this. And they'll fight tooth and nail seeing other perspectives or to weighing what are the consequences, right? You can do this and you can say that, but there's secondary and tertiary consequences. And there's also unanticipated consequences that you have to think of. There's moving parts. There's combinatorial issues, right? There's just sheer practicality that's involved. You know, it's like, okay, well, that might sound really good as an ideal, but, you know, is that really feasible? Is it feasible? And there were people that were, the setup was not, I was really frustrated because the setup was purposely set up so that anybody could disrupt progress. And oftentimes what that led to was stalling and prohibiting real progress and it made for a lot of wasted effort and a lot of frustration. I have to temper my own because I grew up in a different era and I think like a business person. And for the kids involved, a lot of it, what was frustrating to me was probably good for them to go through that process. And so I have to, you know, weigh my own, you know, it's like, it might've been frustrating for me, but it might've been, you know, good for them. But for me, a lot of it was counterproductive. There's a happy medium, and that was not a happy medium. It was too chaotic. I think there's a reason that we ended up being a representational democracy as opposed to just a purely open democracy, because a representational democracy is a balance. You know, it allows certain people to have an ongoing presence as opposed to just show up one evening and say, I disagree, and stop the whole thing, even though they hadn't been involved for, you know, 2 months prior, right? They just show up for meeting and say, I don't like that. It has to be like this instead, and just stop the whole thing and end up wasting a whole evening going back and forth in a meaningless fashion that ends up not leading, you know, leading anywhere. And then they never should, you know, the next following week, they don't even show up. They showed up one evening just for the purpose of disrupting things and then went away, and that was the end of that. I found that terribly frustrating. So it was a lesson to me, actually. On the whole, it was something that needed to happen, and I'm really glad that it happened. I'm so grateful that these folks sacrificed what they did in order to do what they did. I'm really sad that they were taken out of context and in many cases abused. In a lot of cities around, they were abused by law enforcement, by powers that be. I was on a sidewalk, for example, that there were some kids that were holding up signs that on the sidewalk to cars passing by, right? And there were a lot of cars passing by, and they were honking their horn in agreement, right? It's like, yay, you know, keep it up, right? And then some guys, middle-aged guys, or they were young middle-aged. They were, you know, like, I don't know, probably early 30s. Old enough that they should have known better. I'm the oldster. I'm standing in there, and these kids are just doing nothing but holding up signs, right? And these guys dressed in suits, these are professionals, you know, walked by, knocked the signs out of their hands, and stomped all over them. And I'd walk up to these guys. I figure, I'm old, right? I'm an old woman. They're not going to give me, you know, that kind of crap, right? And I walk up to him and I look him straight in the eye and say, how rude. Is that the way your mother raised you? How rude is that? And I would just confront them.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Well, I was at one of the anti-war protests, just watching it on Wall Street during Vietnam, and when the construction workers started beating up on the hippie types, and that was awful. You mentioned your Facebook pages before. You're the most prolific poster of political and social things of anyone I know on Facebook, and I mentioned that earlier that I share many of your things and I curate them for my newspaper. Obviously, your postings put you on the left. Did you grow up on the left, or was that a progression once you were out in the working world and seeing things around you?
Very much a progression. I my parents were very. My dad was working in a factory, and my brother and I have had so many conversations. My brother was actually in Denver. Have had so many conversations about this. My family was pretty conservative and voted Republican, you know, all the time. Even though, you know, my parents were dependent on Social Security. They, you know, my dad got benefits of all the union, the factory worker, right? He got benefits all of the union and that with vacation and health care and pension and all that stuff. And he was, even given that, he was not a supporter, for example, of FDR, which my brother and I, it's like, oh, we don't get it. But I was naive, and I grew up, and I kind of accepted that because I didn't know better. And then over the years, oh, let's just say that the older I get, the more liberal I get.
I agree.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your resume that you consider yourself a dot connector and the people connector, and you've been focusing on social entrepreneurship. What do you mean by those words?
Oh, well, you see me as being a people connector. That's mostly Facebook and to some extent LinkedIn, but mostly Facebook. Facebook. I mean, I recognize Facebook as being a game changer, absolutely a game changer, because it I see Facebook and I see social media is the new Gutenberg press. And I do that. I look at that as from a systems perspective. The with the Gutenberg press, and you know, there was a lot of pushback on that, to say the least, right? Because it interrupted the hierarchical control of communication, oppression of people and communication between people, because it allowed now people to read on their own. Of course, you know, initially with publishing the Bible, but this is the first time now, you know, people could get a copy of the Bible and they could read it for themselves, right? And so it started literacy, and so now all of a sudden, you know, the priests started losing control because, you know, they were the filter, right? They were filtering everything. They were controlling everybody, and they were, to a great extent, they were doing that by controlling, you know, the message. They were controlling all communication. It was all top-down, you know, interpretation from top-down, and it was, you know, it was heresy if you tried to figure this out on your own. And so the Gutenberg press disrupted that hierarchy. Social media is being dead on steroids, the next level. It directly links person to person to person to person in a networked fashion, that not only is it control top-down of communication, that where people can read on their own, like the Gutenberg press did, this now connects people to collaborate one-on-one-on-one without being dependent on somebody saying, you know, you have to go through us in order to talk to each other.
There's a great book about this.
Really?
From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg by John Norton. And it goes into many things, including how the brain had to change to make the transition to reading, because we weren't wired that way. We were wired to take our information in orally. Also, that taking our information in orally meant that we were more in community, we were more with other people, whereas reading becomes the solitary thing where we'd go off to ourselves to read. And it's a terrific book. It is.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm going to have to get it. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. You also mentioned as passion sustainability and thrivability. I understand sustainability. What specifically do you mean by thrivability?
Well, there's a whole book out that written on that. I'm just going to, I'm going to sound really naive and just kind of take my own. But sustainability basically means that, you can live, right? You can survive, but whether it's a person or a community or a business or a town, whatever, a nation, a thrivability is basically quality of life. You can live. Is life worth living?
Okay.
So a child. It applies everywhere, right? In kids develop, child development, right? Does a kid thrive or not? Just feeding a kid and keeping them physically alive, that's sustainability. But is this, kid thriving? Growing and learning and enjoying and, exploring and inventing and doing all those good things that kids should be doing and that we should be doing all through our lives. So one is, is a person and an organization, however large or small you call that organization, able to sustain itself, or is it going to crash and burn? This is a whole risk thing again, right? What's keeping you up at night? Are you making those kinds of decisions that are going to allow you to survive? Kodak, right? They didn't do such a good job of it. Detroit didn't do such a good job of it. The people who are controlling Detroit, right? So staying alive is one thing, but having a quality of life is another layer above that.
I get it.
Okay.
You mentioned your parents and voting Republican, even though your father was the factory worker. There's a terrific book by a recent guest on the show, Joan Walsh, who you've probably seen She's an MSNBC a commentator, and it sounds as though it's a book that's that sounds very radical on race relations. What's the matter with white people? But it's far from that. It's the question of how that they allowed this whole group to be separated through Nixon's Southern strategy and everything into a racial separation rather than a working people versus capital separation. How we haven't been able to see that there are so many things that transcend race and they have to do with economics and we've allowed the resentment toward black working people to be built up with white working people. We've really split what should be people having common interests, and then as other people have said, they wind up voting against their own interests because of race rather than saying
what's
happening to jobs.
There's an old quote that is attributed to LBJ, I think. I think it was LBJ was attributed to, I think it was Bill Moyers attributed this quote to LBJ. I'm going by memory now. I'm pretty sure what I just said is correct. I won't 100% guarantee it, but I'm pretty sure memory serves me. But this quote by LBJ is with something, I'm going to have to paraphrase it, I'll probably murder it along the way, but something basically that if you can get the poorest white person to look down on a black person, then not only will you distract them, and I'm really murdering this now, not only will you distract them where you can pick their pocket, but you know they will open your pockets, their pockets to you, because they'll feel like they're entitled to look down on somebody else. And the thing with black people is they're identifiable. I mean, they have a different color skin, and so they're identifiable. And so you single them out, you target them, you single them out, and I might be poor, but at least I'm not them.
Right. Sure. Pete Hamill wrote a column years ago talking about, and he was anti-war, but he was talking about the young people who were calling cops pigs, and he said, as soon as you start labeling people as gooks or kikes or pigs or whatever, that you can do things to them that you couldn't do if you had to look at them as a human being.
Absolutely.
And that's
well,
true
Irish,
throughout history.
Aren't you Irish?
By extraction, sure. No Irish need apply up in Boston.
Absolutely.
Nina,
yeah.
We've covered a whole lot of base in exploring your interesting life. What's next for you?
Oh, well, I don't know. I need to find work. I'm hoping that one or more of these things that I've got, cooking right now kicks off. I either need to get, employed with a normal employer again or get something like a combination of something like, what I'm working on right now going such that, I can tag along and, get some, part-time remuneration doing something with it. Like with Harvey, I'm ready to start writing, grant proposals or, whatever, do business plans, write grant proposals and that. And there may or may not be a role. I mean, I would feel good if that came to fruition because it's worthwhile doing. I would hope that eventually there would be some role for me that I could get some remuneration, but, I will do it regardless. Or I want to do it regardless, and hopefully I'll be able to have some success. But, who knows? There might be some remuneration in there, if there's a contract that would require my skills, I would certainly, throw my hat in the ring to do, that work as part of a contract. or part of grant. The court thing, I'm not a court executive, but, they do a lot of the kind of stuff that requires my expertise. And if I can get, some role in doing that, I would love to do that. Doing case management, doing basically I'm an analyst, right? So doing analysis with regard to case management processes and design I know where some of the basic improvements need to be made in those court systems. I know for a fact where some of those improvements need to be made, and I would love to be able to help them do that, right? If I could, be part of a task force. I would love to go back to the employer where I was just laid off this fall with my employer. I would love to go back there, actually. There needs to be a task order for me. So we'll see.
What else might you like our audience to know about Linda Larson Kemp?
Oh my goodness, I don't know. We need to fix this country for one thing. We need to fix this country. We need to live up to our ideal. And we need to turn ourselves into being a thrivable country. And that's a big, John, you're going to appreciate this, I think. That's a big systems problem. That's a really big, complex systems problem.
Do you see any real hope, though, when you have representatives talking about that women are a lesser being because they were made from man's ribs and ribs aren't the prime cut, or that we have people who there are people that want to force women to have vaginal ultrasounds when the ultrasound could be done some other way, but it wouldn't be as humiliating, or when we have people that are blaming illegal aliens for bringing all the measles into the country. I mean, is there any hope? Well, we have all the crazy stuff going on.
There is hope. I think there is hope, and it's from a multiple factions. I think I see social media, quite frankly, is a large tool, like the Gutenberg press, right? It's a large tool to enable people themselves to say, that's a crock, right? And to build critical mass. To get it changed. I'm disappointed that there are too many women who, like my father, voted against his own interests, right? Tended to vote Republican, even though back in the day there were some honorable Republicans, quite frankly. For the most part, most of them have gone away, as far as I'm concerned. I don't really see anybody. They've been driven out. But Dad and Mom would have followed him, even though she was barely independent. She kind of saw things the same way. And he was voting against his own interests then. He would still be, if he was still alive today, he would still be voting against his own interests, because he would have this notion of, Republicans are, staunch and they're trustworthy and they're, we can trust them and they have our best interests at heart, blah, 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 blah. People are voting, women are voting against their own interests. A lot of it goes back to that old quote from LBJ, which is one of the drivers that gets people to vote against their own interests. You target somebody. I mean, this is an old propaganda technique, right? You find somebody to target. And it's like a pickpocket technique. right? You get somebody to focus on something else. You distract them to focus on something else, right? So you pick a target, and you get them to target their interest and their hatred and their blame against somebody. It doesn't matter who. I mean, look at the litany of people who were targeted throughout just the American history, right? The Irish, the Chinese, the Italians, the Mexicans, the blacks, the whatever, right? In Upper New England, I think my understanding is the French Canadians are targeted.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And so it doesn't really, you know, there's a target. It doesn't really matter. You get people to hate that target. And those people make themselves vulnerable to their pockets being picked, essentially, you know, to being exploited. And that's what I see happening. It's the same dynamic that hit, my family. My dad was, voted Republican, which is against his own interests. Even though he was a Social Security recipient, he didn't see that it was FDR. He was blind to the fact it was FDR that allowed him to live a dignified retirement. He would not have had a dignified retirement.
But in those days, anyhow, I remember my father reading position papers from Robert Taft and from Adlai Stevenson, the people,
yeah.
And he took the time to read them. Now we have the soundbite society. Now we have people who wouldn't watch that speech by Ronald Reagan that really brought him to attention because he spoke for 45 minutes for Barry Goldwater. How many people do you know would watch a political speech for 45 minutes, particularly by someone who wasn't running for office? I mean, we've gotten down to getting rid of complexity. We've gotten rid to looking for easy answers about everything.
Yeah.
And that scares the hell out of me.
That I totally agree with you. You and I actually are in some circles that I would watch 45 minutes. You would watch 45 minutes. And I would tell you that there's a whole bunch of people that were both who would watch 45 minutes. No problem at all. The problem is, the problem is there are too many others who won't. Way, 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 way too many others who won't. They used to say that what religion is, who was it used to say that religion is the opiate of the masses?
Karl Marx.
Was that him? Okay.
Yep.
As far as I'm concerned, today, it's sports and mindless TV.
Well, I'm a sports fan, so I don't quite buy that. But situation comedies, I think, are the opiate of the masses. Two and a Half Men and things like that. Things that have gotten base, they've gotten sexist, and they would have been knocked off the air by censors 25 years ago, I'm glad that you're hopeful, and it's just been terrific. Thank you very much for tonight, Lynn. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate you. You are a really cool guy. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Just a bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton. Credit John Simon and historian Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available on Amazon, and I blog at open.salon.com/blogs/JohnMack13. This blog, by the way, is available automatically on Kindles for the exorbitant rate of 99 cents per month. Then those who sign up right now will even have the link to this show permanently on their Kindles. Send any comments or questions to me once again at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after a Mets win, even though that Linda doesn't like sports, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs for previous shows, the schedule of upcoming shows, and the path to the GoFundMe location to keep this show going. Tune in next week for the 77th show in the series. Until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady silver, steady, steady silver. Thank you again, Lynn. It was terrific.
Are you here?